This is Community in Conversation with Kathy Kayla, starting conversations that matter.
Good morning, I'm Kathy Kayla, and thank you for joining me for this Community in Conversation. She's an actor, a writer, a producer, and a doctor of neuroscience, I kid you not. You probably know her from Big Bang Theory, Blossom, or My and Bialik's Breakdown on YouTube. Join me for the next hour in conversation with Mayim Bialik.
Good morning. How are you?
Oh, so well. Thank you. Thank you so much for the time.
Of course. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Mayim, you were raised in a reform home. Today you live an observant or modern Orthodox life. What spoke to you about Orthodox Judaism?
I think it's important also to say that I try not to live by a label, and I think a lot of Jews are finding that it's hard to fit into just one box. And especially when politics becomes part of the conversation, we look like all sorts of different things. So there's definitely something for me, when I was in college that resonated for me about the structure of traditional Judaism. So I try and think of it more as traditional Judaism rather than, you know, because a lot of people have preconceived notions about what that means, Orthodox or modern Orthodox even. So there's a lot that really appealed to me about having more of an active, I think, contact with the notion of a guiding force in the universe, you know, which some of us call God and some of us call other things. But also I really like structure. I mean, that always was something I loved about Judaism, even though I was raised Reform. You know, my mom was raised Orthodox. She's kind of a recovering Orthodox Jew is the, kind of how I think of it. So there were a lot of remnants, you know, of Orthodoxy in my childhood. And a lot of them really resonated with me, having structure and marking the seasons and, you know, living by a concept of Jewish law. It really spoke to me. And I am a person who likes things organized. I like rules. I like boundaries. So that really worked for me, I guess.
Isn't that something that's very human, though? You know, as a Balei Tshuva, that's something, what you're saying really resonates with me because I loved structure and there is a lot of freedom within parameters.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of different ways to approach observance, but for me, you know, having some sort of framework that I know to follow is helpful. You know, having thousands of years of research and writings and philosophy around it is also really important. And, you know, I think for a lot of people, you know, at least here in America, where we're, you know, about 2% of the population, there's a lot of misunderstandings about sort of what it means to even be an observant Jew. And the fact is there's so much of our culture that kind of intermingles, even if you're not observant, that I understand to others it can be confusing. It's confusing to me, you know, and I'm part of it.
And also a lot of things that we take for granted as a Jewish community. You know, when you're part of a Jewish community, you're part of a nation. You know, even though we're sitting here as a Jewish community in the tip of Africa, of the African continent, we hear the name Mayim Bialik and you're ours.
I mean, oh, that's really beautiful. It's really flattering. And, you know, what I think about is that when I know that there are Jews in South Africa, I feel like that's ours too. And I think it's kind of interesting as a public Jew that people get to sort of like know who I am. And I love that there's a sense of ownership. I think it really does kind of work both ways because for me, one shouldn't have to be a public person also to feel part of that nation, you know, and that's absolutely true.
Does the Jewish community support you? Do you feel our love?
Yeah, I think that my publicist could vouch for that's, you know, kind of one of the strongest senses of community I think that I have, because obviously I wear a lot of hats. You know, I'm a vegan and I'm an actor and I'm an artist and
mom.
Things like that, but I'm a mom, right? And so I appreciate that love, but also I think with all those other communities, it's very easy to offend those communities and be on kind of the wrong side of an issue. Whereas, you know, even among Jews, I feel like there's a tremendous amount of diversity. And I'd like to think that I've experienced a lot of people saying, I don't agree with, let's say, your thoughts on Israel or observance, but there's still a notion that we are still kind of united, and I'm really grateful I've gotten to experience that.
No, being such a public figure, you are often attacked, especially on very toxic platforms like Twitter, for your opinions on Israel. And as a Zionist Jew, I just want to thank you for speaking up for the rest of us. I really do appreciate that, Maim. And I know that I'm speaking for a lot of people when I say that. I watched your speech that you gave in Israel, and you went through the different categories of anti-Semitism that you've experienced on Twitter. And it was just, it was so confronting. How do you deal with that?
I mean, first of all, thank you. You know, I think a lot of the quote hate, you know, that I've gotten is often from people who don't take issue with, let's say, my stance on Israel or Israeli politics. It's generally people who just don't believe Israel has a right to exist. So I think it's an important point, and it's a very sobering point that I've had to learn, that it doesn't matter that I'm a liberal. It doesn't matter that I'm a liberal Zionist. It doesn't matter all of, I mean, to many people. And I think to people who have, you know, that loud platform and that loud microphone, especially on places like Twitter, the internet is an unbelievable, important, significant, fantastic thing. You know, I don't even have to say that. It's so clear. However, it's also a place where people can have a very, very loud microphone, you know, with which to disseminate a lot of information. In many cases, that's not even true. And then once it goes, it kind of has a life of its own. I'm not superhuman. You know, I have feelings too. I happen to be a very sensitive person. So that stuff does impact me. It's been years since I've, you know, kind of stuck it out and engaged in an active political Twitter fight, because it's really bad for my mental health. Just, you know, it stays with me. It's hard for me not to be emotional about those things. So I've had to limit a lot of what I do.
Let's talk about mental health. One of your projects, which I just love, I subscribe to it, I just love it. It's called Mind Bialik's Breakdown on YouTube. Go and check it out. Go and subscribe to the channel. Quirky, informative, and interactive podcast breaking down the myths and misunderstandings about mental health and emotional well-being. She breaks down mental health so that we don't have to, because apparently we're not as intelligent as we used to be.
Well, and also we videotape, we record it, so it's available on YouTube, but we are a podcast, and that's actually, you know, where most of our downloads come from. So we're available on Spotify and anywhere that you get other podcasts. My partner, Jonathan Cohen, and I it started over COVID. I was aware how much my mental health and my anxiety was spiking. You know, there was so much uncertainty and, you know, anticipatory anxiety is, I guess, what it's called. We didn't know what was going to happen. Obviously, the pandemic is hugely impactful on our mental health. Also, it was a time in this country where we didn't know who to trust. We didn't know what was going to come out of the president's Twitter account on any given day. It was a very stressful time. So we started this podcast because we felt like, gosh, you know, I have resources, right? I have a therapist. I have access to all those things. So many people don't have that or aren't there yet. So that really was kind of how we started. And we talked to people who are experts in their own mental health, talked to a lot of prominent people. We had Matthew McConaughey on. We just dropped our Molly Ringwald episode, which is really exciting. We've had Kunal Nair from The Big Bang Theory. His episode is spectacular. And also some of the actors that I work with now, Cheyenne Jackson and Leslie Jordan. So we've had some unbelievable people who really want to open up about their mental health challenges. And then we also feature experts, you know, actual experts, people who spend and dedicate their life to helping others manage mental health. And we have a lot of fun, and that is our podcast.
Do you think that being a doctor of neuroscience actually equips you to be a better interviewer on mental health issues?
Not for the reasons you think. You know, my training as a neuroscientist is very specific. You know, I studied obsessive compulsive disorder and the hypothalamic, adrenal axis. So that doesn't necessarily make you a better interviewer. But, you know, I did spend many, many years learning about people. And, you know, as someone who's been in therapy since I was a teenager, I definitely have, I think that probably qualified me more as I've learned more about my own feelings and how I like to be spoken to and how space can be held for people. That's sort of the, you know, holistic term. So I think it's more just sort of my experience. Honestly, also, like, it's a very Jewish practice to talk, to hold space, to turn an issue over and over. You know, it's a very I kind of approach my life in sort of a, you know, halachic analysis, you know, so that's sort of, I guess, what influences it as well.
That's fascinating. And only you don't use the thumbs.
In my personal life, I definitely use my thumbs to gesture and make a point.
You really are such a delight to speak to. You're very sincere.
Oh, thank you. I like to say I'm a very normal person. I just have very unusual things to talk about.
I actually posted on my Facebook page that I was going to be interviewing you. And I don't believe that it should only be my privilege. I want to extend that to listeners. And of course, because we are pre-recording it, I asked for them to post their questions. Your parents must be deeply disappointed in your lack of achievement. That's from Sam Swain. How funny. You really are an overachiever, Mayim.
Well, it's funny because I do get a lot of questions, jokes about that, but it's something I've spoken about on the podcast. My mom was raised, you know, as I said, in Orthodoxy, and I was raised in a very kind of traditional, you know, household. And the fact is, you know, not to get heavy, but, you know, being married is a very high value, you know, in my family, in our culture, in the Jewish community. So it's kind of funny that something that's very hard for me, and I do talk about it a lot, is I've been divorced for 10 years. I have a 13 and a 16 year old, but there is kind of a notion that there's something still to sort of being a divorced woman that feels a little bit like, you know, a small scarlet letter in, especially in traditional, you know, communities. It's still not as common. And so it's definitely something that comes up with me and my mom in particular. But yeah, my father of blessed memory, has passed, but was very proud of me, very proud of my achievements. You know, of course, when you have a parent pass, there's things you always wish that they could have seen. I got to direct my first movie this summer, and that's something I really, you know, can't imagine that I did without my father to witness it. But yeah, my mom thinks I'm the greatest person, and that's adorable and lovely. And she's also on the podcast sometimes, which are some people's favorite episodes.
Every Jewish mother thinks you're the bee's knees, not just your mother. Mark Hummel wants to know, says, I want to know, please, how the cast of Big Bang all got on with each other. It seems like they had real fun while shooting the scenes. And is Jim anything like Sheldon in real life?
Jim is like Sheldon in that he's very intelligent, very articulate, very particular. You know, he's a very, very careful actor. But that's kind of the extent of it. He's very funny. He can be silly. He's wonderful. We actually produce together the show that I work on, which is Call Me Cat. So he and I are executive producers together, and that's an indication of how much we like each other. We actually produced a show together or continue to work together. Our cast did get along very well. You know, obviously with any combination of individuals over two people, you're going to have different alliances that are stronger than others, meaning, you know, there's people who you vibe with more. But we really did enjoy working together. These are people who you spend more time with than your own family. Honestly, I was there for, you know, 9 years. That's where my time was, really. And I'm grateful, you know, Melissa Rausch, who played Bernadette, she and I were added at the same time on the cast. So we had a really special bond because of that. I've known Johnny Galecki since I'm, gosh, 13 years old. You know, there were different relationships we all had among that group, but we really did. We operated like a family.
Do Jewish celebs gravitate towards one another?
I think it's a little bit like it is in non-celebrity world, where there is a special sort of connection. Yeah, in many cases, you're dealing with similar things. Simon Helberg, who's on our Big Bang Theory cast, he's in the movie that I just directed. And he's someone who's not necessarily observant, but I feel extremely connected to as a Jewish person. Kevin Sussman, who played the comic book store owner on Big Bang Theory, he and I connected a lot, especially Jewishly. Melissa Rausch is also Jewish. So yeah, we definitely had people to wish Happy New Year. You know, when it was the Jewish New Year, we would also have Hanukkah on the set of Big Bang Theory. When we would have tape nights, there were many Jews on our crew, and so we would all gather and light candles together. But, you know, for me, if I were to see Sacha Baron Cohen at an event, yes, I would feel more entitled to go up to him because I'm Jewish, and that sounds crazy, and I don't know that he'd appreciate that. But, yeah, I definitely have that feeling, and, you know, I was raised in, you know, kind of a post-Holocaust mentality of like, look, we made it, you know. I was raised with like, oh my gosh, did you know, you know, that this person's Jewish? Like, that's very much, you know, the culture that I grew up in. So that definitely stayed with me. I get really tickled when, you know, when Jewish celebrities, you know, are at events that I'm at and things like that.
But it's a funny thing because we recognize one another. Even if it's a right. stranger, you just know that that person is Jewish and nobody else would be able to distinguish. But we know one another. It's almost like we different parts of the same organism.
Yeah, I have a lot of family in Israel and have gone about every other year since I'm 16. There's also been a tremendous shift because of the waves of immigration into Israel so that we now look so different and we can still be the same. I was alive when the Ethiopian immigration was at its peak. So the face of soldiers now looks so different. It's so beautiful. It's so diverse. And yet there is still that kind of that unity.
It's beautiful. It really is beautiful. A few months ago, I did a podcast on the lost tribes of Israel.
Oh, wow.
And there's this producer who has identified 10 of them, of which 4 of them are from the Pathan tribes of Afghanistan.
Oh, my goodness. That's amazing.
Can you imagine all these Jews and just recognition of the tribes? And we think as Jews, I don't know, for some reason we seem to think that all other Jews need to look like us and the 12 tribes need to look like us. But the truth is that each tribe had its own decal and its own identity. And we need to expand our own thinking and be more inclusive rather than exclusive.
Absolutely.
I want to get to some of these other messages that came through. So many questions for you on my Facebook page. It's ridiculous. You really are very loved. There's one here from Nick Ferris. Nick says, I know she's married. Actually, you're not.
Not anymore.
but he wants to know if you will put him on your list because he loves a smart woman.
Yes, Nick, I can put you on my list, but also I'd like to point out there are many, many smart women out there.
He said, sign me up. Either way, I adore her. Saw an interview she did with Graham Norton. She's spectacular. He said, well, it's like this. I have half a chance with any of these fan women. Mayim, Gal, and you. Don't you just love being grouped with Gal Gadot?
And with you.
Yeah. Yeah, of course, with me. Hilarious. A serious question that comes from Nick. He says, the real reason to message you is to mention that people like mine play characters that are on the spectrum, and it makes them or us feel normal. We struggle in social situations, and the patience and love the characters play is hope that there is someone for everyone. And I think that that's a truth. And don't you love that?
Yeah, that was Bill Prady, who created and executive produced Big Bang Theory. I actually interviewed him on My and B. Alex Breakdown. So that's an episode to look up if people are Big Bang fans. That was something that was, you know, particularly close to Bill Prady's heart. Bill Prady's on the spectrum and talked a lot about, you know, sort of the origin of a lot of these characters as people that he worked with when he was in programming. And, you know, this is one of our kind of favorite things that our show was able to sort of communicate to people. And we didn't talk about diagnoses. We didn't talk about medication. We didn't talk about people needing to be fixed or changed. Of course, there were things about, you know, Sheldon or even Amy, you know, that others would have liked to change. But these were characters really living their best lives as they were. And it was important to us to show that people who are different in this way can have successful friendships, careers, and relationships.
I love how humanity is getting so many things right. You know, what was that series about the doctor with autism? Did you ever see it on Netflix?
No.
It's about this doctor, and because of his autism, he's able to do these amazing diagnoses and find solutions that other doctors just don't see.
Oh wow! Was it the Stanley Tucci one?
Maybe.
Because Monk, I think Monk was about he had OCD.
No, it wasn't Monk. Hold on. Now I have to Google this. I'm sorry, it's called The Good Doctor.
Check it out.
I think you would really love that. TV shows and recommendations aside, Jeff Lieberman wants to know. He says, "I would be curious to know who your Jewish heroes were growing up."
Jewish heroes growing up. You know, I grew up with a strong notion that my grandparents were my heroes. You know, they fled Eastern Europe in the pogroms leading up to the Holocaust. And my grandmother lost half of her siblings as she fled. They all fled separately. So I grew up with a very strong sense of like, these were my stories. I remember learning about Hannah Senish. You know, I learned about all of the kind of heroes and heroines that we are taught about, but I was very, you know, I'm very kind of biblically centered, meaning like the women of the Torah, women like Deborah really resonated with me when I was, you know, when I was young. And also as I've gotten older, you know, learning more about the missing voices of women and places that we can learn more about also the women and the roles that they played. That was always something very inspiring for me. You know, I grew up loving comedians, you know, and many were not Jewish, meaning like Lucille Ball and Carol Burnett and Tracy Ullman. But I definitely grew up resonating with a specific sense of humor and in particular a very Jewish sense of humor. I was raised on like the comedy of Jackie Mason, you know, who recently passed away. And, you know, I was raised with that very kind of Borscht Belt kind of, you know, appreciation for comedy. I've always been a person who identified with the God of the Jewish people. And so that's always been, you know, a source of inspiration for me. But yeah, I guess looking to my own family has also been, you know, very inspiring.
And a source for comedy, I'm sure.
Yes, we're hilarious.
Jessica Schwartzman wants to know, what was it like performing as a youngster, especially in your first movie alongside Bette Midler? And are you still singing today?
You know, I started acting at 11. Beaches actually was not my first job, but it was my second movie that I had done. And it was incredible and bizarre, you know, to have just really started acting and kind of a year later to be cast to play the young Bette Midler. But I do still sing. I was a liturgical singer. I was a lay cantor for my community. I went to UCLA. We have a very strong Hillel, which is a, you know, egalitarian kind of all denominational Jewish organization. It's where I took on more observance, and part of it was learning to sing. And I ended up leading services with our rabbi, as kind of our substitute lay cantor for many years. So I actually love liturgical singing. I sing in a quartet. And it's something I've continued. We have a quartet for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. I think there was one more question in there. Did I miss it?
She wanted to know, how was it singing, playing or acting opposite Bette Midler?
Okay, I guess I covered it then.
But you know, have you maintained a relationship with Bette Midler or not? Is it just too many generations apart?
No, I mean, I think what people need to reframe when they think about that is Beaches came out the week of my bat mitzvah. It was 1988. So there were no cell phones. Like, we were still using full-size tape answering machines. Like, people didn't keep in touch that way. It just didn't exist, you know? Our lives were so different. And I was in junior high. Like, you know, it was very different. I did an appearance on a talk show here, and she had been a guest like the week before, and she left me a recorded message. So that was a handful of years back, and that was really lovely. But yeah, it's a very different world, you know?
That's beautiful that she did that.
Yeah, it was really nice.
That's very special. Maim, do you use your celebrity to further science, or do you use science to further your celebrity?
That's a good question. As a person who dedicated so many years of my life to the scientific community, I have great respect for that community and also acknowledge that I'm not an active member of the science community like I used to be.
But you won the Nobel. Hold on. You got the Nobel.
Well, my character did. I taught neuroscience for about 5 years after getting my degree before I was made a regular on the Big Bang Theory and, you know, wasn't able to do that anymore. I definitely have been an advocate for technology, for science, technology, engineering, and math, you know, for the STEM fields. So that's something that I've been grateful to do. But really just putting a positive face on science and a female face on science has been something that I think is ultimately most important.
Can you tell our listeners a little bit about Prader-Willi syndrome? I went and I looked at it. If I wasn't interviewing you, I would have never known about it.
Yeah, Prader-Willi syndrome is a genetic syndrome. It's a spontaneous mutation, and it occurs in about 1 in 15,000 people. It's a very important syndrome. Actually, a tremendous amount of the research around Prader-Willi syndrome is genetic and comes out of Israel, as a matter of fact. And it was the first example of genomic imprinting, which is that depending which parent you get a certain region of chromosome, you will get a different syndrome. So with this region, it's on chromosome 15. And if you inherit it from your father or your mother, it's a different syndrome. So Prader-Willi syndrome or Angelman syndrome are the two syndromes that occur from this particular region. So it's a genetically very important syndrome, and they have a very specific profile. The genetics of it make it so that they have changes in how they perceive feeling full. And there's often an inability to stop eating. And it's not just being hungry all the time. There's a very specific profile. It starts with difficulty as an infant, which then shifts around toddlerhood, and also a very specific psychiatric profile. And so I studied the rates of OCD in this community, and it's a really beautiful community. I participate in a lot of charity work that they do, and there's a Prader-Willi Syndrome Association here in the U.S., and there are chapters all over the world. And so that was the syndrome that was part of my thesis.
Why did you choose that syndrome for your thesis?
I was always interested in working in the field of special needs, and as a vegan, I don't work with animals, so there's a more limited choice of thesis study if you won't work with animals in neuroscience. And so this is one of the fields, and when I started learning about one of the labs at UCLA where professors were studying this, it really felt like something that I wanted to lend my neuroscience brain to. I do happen to have OCD, but that's not why I chose it for my thesis topic. So
it's very interesting when I was thinking about you and thinking about the different angles to take on this, because you are just such a multi-dimensional human being. Not everybody seems to have as many dimensions as you do. Right. Mm-hmm. You do things to the nth degree. You don't do anything by half measures. When you act, you act. When you want to, when your mother's hucking you about getting a career in science or whatever the case may be, as every Jewish mother, stop with the acting. Go and get a real job.
Right.
You do that to the nth degree. You don't just stop at your postgraduate. You get your doctorate. You really are incredibly adaptable. What have you sacrificed in order to do all the things that you've done?
That's a great question. You know, I think with any door opening, there are doors that close. When I chose to be home with my children, you know, I closed the door on a much more lucrative, in terms of academia, much more lucrative academic path. Those are hard decisions, and there's special decisions that women make about our career. And when we have children, if we'd like to actually give birth to them, it changes our body. It changes all sorts of things. And that's its own, you know, kind of sacrifice, and one that, you know, I did gratefully. I don't have a private life. You know, that's something that I don't want pity for. I don't feel like, oh, poor me. Every decision comes with the other side of that decision, which is things that you lose or miss out on. But a lot of the things that have happened in my life have happened, you know, especially in the industry, because of a lot of luck. It's not like I said, I'm ready to be on a TV show. All those things happened kind of one after the other. There's so many parts that had to happen, and so much, you know, care and observation by my parents to try and keep me as grounded as possible. So there's kind of all these steps, and on a daily basis, I don't really feel different from other people. I have the same struggles. I'm 45. My body hurts in ways that it didn't, just like getting out of bed sometimes. I have limitations as a woman. You know, we kind of become invisible in a lot of ways after 40. And, you know, I have all those challenges and body image stuff. And I have the same anxieties as a lot of people about COVID and what we're supposed to do next. And, you know, mostly I'm a mom. You know, that's where a lot of my brain kind of goes, is to my kids. You know, that's its own sacrifice. You know, I see people who don't have children, and they do whatever they want, whenever they want. They go to Disneyland if they want to on any given day. You know? And that's just, you know, that's just kind of like the ups and downs of being human. There's always things that close when other doors open.
So I'm working on a theory that when we sacrifice something for the good of another, we create a vessel for blessing.
That's a really beautiful way to think about it. And it's a very Jewish way. So, you know, that makes sense too. But I think in general, you know, I try and see everything as kind of a trade-off in some ways. And I think the challenge for those of us who are people of faith is to believe that it's okay. The good is okay. The bad is okay. God doesn't think in terms of good and bad. God just is, you know. A lot of the things that happen, we wish they wouldn't, and we also are completely powerless over that.
Do you see God's hand? Do you see Hashem's hand in where you are and who you are today?
No more or no less than I see quote, God's hand in everybody's life. I don't place myself above. To me, I don't think, you know, God doesn't have a Twitter account, as it were, or God is all of the Twitter accounts, you know, is the other way to look at it. So, you know, I don't feel like I've won, you know, any sort of popularity contest with God. I value my faith as much if I'm successful as if I'm not.
I'm Kathy Kaler, and this is Community in Conversation. My guest this morning is actor, writer, producer, and doctor of neuroscience, Mayim Bialik.
Can I talk a little bit about Amy Farrah Fowler?
Sure.
Who is just the most likable, wonderful character. What romantic advice would you give her if you were her friend?
I think that the advice I would give Amy Farrah Fowler is pretty much, you know, what our writers intended for her. She had a partner who's very unusual and has a lot of quirks, and she found ways to stick it out with him and love him through that. And I think that's really beautiful. And I think that's kind of the example that I took, you know, from getting to play that character.
One of the major storylines of The Big Bang Theory was the love affair between Sheldon Cooper and Amy Farrah Fowler. This is their negotiation on intimacy. Let's take a listen.
At this moment, I find myself craving human intimacy and physical contact.
Oh, boy. You know ours is a relationship of the mind.
Proposal. One wild night of torrid lovemaking that soothes my soul and inflames my loins.
Counter proposal. I will gently stroke your head and repeat, "Aw, who's a good Amy?"
How about this? French kissing. 7 minutes in heaven, culminating in second base.
Neck massage. Then you get me that beverage.
We cuddle. Final offer.
Look, I mean, Amy and Sheldon dated for 5 years before they had coitus.
They were a very slow-moving couple.
Very. Do you have any thoughts on sex before marriage?
I have a lot of thoughts on sex before marriage.
Okay, this is a family radio station. So if you
I think generally speaking, you know, I think it's fair to say I was raised in a very, very traditional house. And my parents met as teenagers in the 60s at a time when that really was, you know, you'd meet the first person you dated and essentially marry them and stay married for 53 years was a lot of the pattern that I grew up with as the sort of norm. Like that was seen as like there's one goal to a relationship and a life. I think a lot of Jewish and other immigrant, you know, families or generations of immigrant families can identify that like that was the way to be. So it was definitely a challenge for me growing up in a very different culture, in a very different time. In a lot of ways, my parents raised me like it was the 1940s, but it wasn't. So, I think it's very sweet that Amy and Sheldon, you know, waited as long as they did to have kind of the last element of their intimacy. But it was something we knew that people would have questions about.
Listen, I love that they won the Nobel.
That's the most intimate thing to do together.
Exactly. You've been partly responsible for making science cool. Do you ever think about your impact on pop culture?
Yeah, I mean, I think being part of the Big Bang Theory was a real lesson in sort of the impact that a show can have. And I do love that part of that was the notion of like nerds making their way in the world. The fact that I happened to be a scientist in real life was just sort of the cherry on top. But even if I wasn't a scientist in real life, I think we're all very proud of what our show did in terms of its impact on pop culture and in particular the perception of nerds and what's cool.
You've brought joy and laughter to many millions of people around the world. What makes you laugh?
What makes me laugh? Well, my partner, Jonathan Cohen, who I do the podcast with, you see me laugh till I cry more than once on that podcast. So I highly recommend that people either watch it on YouTube if they haven't seen. There's something we did called What Mayim Hears, which is where Jonathan says completely normal, like, banal statements and my like anxious insecure mind turns it into something else. Those are really, really funny to me. I love stand-up comedy. I was raised on Jackie Mason. You know, there are comedians like Dave Chappelle who make me laugh but also make me think. But, you know, for pure laughter, I really like Jim Carrey movies. I like Will Ferrell. I like slapstick comedy, but I like really smart comedy. I am a Monty Python person, like Fawlty Towers. I grew up on Fawlty Towers. I love, I've shown my kids and I watch Fawlty Towers. Some of the funniest things though is just like me goofing around with my kids, meaning just like the natural sense of humor. I do have a very self-deprecating sense of humor, but you know, Sacha Baron Cohen is a person who obviously I am very proud that he's also very vocal about so many issues. My older son and I have been watching pretty much all of Sacha Baron Cohen, and that's something that's really, really funny to me and beautiful to get to kind of share, also, you know, my sense of humor with the next generation.
It's intelligent comedy. You know, if you look at his series, yeah. What is it called? I think it's Who is America?
We just started rewatching it because watching genius. It once wasn't enough. He's a total genius, and I do really resonate with smart comedy in particular. Yeah.
Can we just talk about holistic parenting? Because there is a parenting comment. This has come from Belinda van der Groot. She wants to know if you're still homeschooling your children, Maim.
Yeah, my boys are still homeschooled.
She wants you to please share your reasons for homeschooling, because she's got a homeschool family, and your story was very encouraging in their early years.
Oh, that's lovely to hear. Yeah, I am divorced now. I got divorced when our kids were 4 and 7. But my ex-husband and I remain co-parents, and we were friends before we got married, and we're still friends now. We were friends before we started dating. We really made the decision that we had kids who developed, quote, late walkers, late talkers, late eaters, like all the things late. And in the school system here, there are definitely general markers for development that they, quote, want. And if you don't hit those, you will often be put in lots of different therapy. And many children need that, and I completely respect that. We did not make these decisions without several doctors' opinions, but we chose to really let them develop at their own pace without the pressure of kind of a structured school system. And indeed, they learned to walk, they learned to talk, they learned to eat, they learned to do all those things at their own pace. But we really loved the freedom. We loved the time with our kids. You know, you have to want to be with your kids to homeschool them. And a lot of people either don't want to, can't, want to be back at a job, and that's completely fine. You know, I like to make the point that like what I do, what anyone does, doesn't have to be an assault on you if you do it differently. For us, this was the best way for our kids to develop. You know, they do go to classes, and now that they're older, they go to more structured classes. But yeah, it's very small classes, and they can take classes that also equip them for later university if they want to do that. My older son is taking his first community college class, and that's not because he's a genius or he's a savant. Many homeschool teenagers around 16, 17 will often start exploring community college classes as they start to build more of their life towards what they want to do next. We love being around our kids. You know, my ex-husband was able to be home with them, but I also like to point out homeschooling is not for wealthy people. It's not for celebrities. I'm the only celebrity that I know in our homeschooling community. Billie Eilish was part of our homeschool community, which is just a really cool thing. But in general, homeschool families sacrifice having two incomes so that one parent can essentially be home. And, you know, that's a decision people make. It's not easy. There are a lot of sacrifices and a lot of challenges, but, you know, my heart also goes out to people during COVID who had to maintain a full-time career while also, quote, homeschooling their kid. And, you know, I like to point out that that's not what homeschooling looks like. It doesn't look like working a full-time job and trying to have your kids schooled. You know, in homeschool families, it's typically one parent is devoted to being home, at least being able to work out of the home to manage the children that way.
Maim Bialik, a million thank yous.
It was worth waking up for.
We will be watching you. We are so proud of you as a community. Just know
thank
that there's a Jewish community at the tip of the continent of Africa who just
thank
are
you.
Claiming you
well,
as ours.
Actually, I can't end this interview without saying that I met my first South African Jew when I was in 8th grade. I'll give a shout out to her. Her name was Karen. And her family had come from South Africa, and her parents were very politically active. I learned all about the community of South Africa from them and from her family. We were friends for many, many years, and we're still in touch. She's a very talented choreographer. I learned so much about Africa in general and about the community, about Nelson Mandela. Like, it was part of my education as a teenager, was learning about the Jews of South Africa. So I know that you are all out there, and I continue to enjoy and love what I learn about that community. I would love to come there and have tried several times. The Jewish community there has invited me, but to be honest, it is very far away and my breaks are so short from work that it has been very hard to figure out enough time to come, get over jet lag, do all the things I want to do and come back and go back to work. So
but you could podcast. You could podcast
exactly.
From here. All right.
It's true.
We're going to work
with
on this.
Schedule, right. A sitcom schedule makes it very difficult, but it's really lovely to meet you and thank you so much.
Being a Friday, I wish you a Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom. And take care.
That was actor, writer, producer, and doctor of neuroscience, Mayim Bialik. One of the greatest pleasures I have in interviewing celebrities is when they are the people we think they are. It's fascinating and amazing to me how it's the biggest stars who are grounded and retain their humility. Just real people going about changing the world. I'm humbled and inspired. Thank you to Mayim Bialik for making herself available to speak to me and our community here on the southern tip of Africa. I wish you and yours a Shabbat Shalom, dear friends. I'm Kathy Kayla for Community in Conversation on 101.9 Chai FM.
It's a Community in Conversation. Join Kathy Kayla every Friday at 9 a.m. for Community in Conversation. Be brave enough to start a conversation that matters. Right here on 101.9 Chai FM.